Welcome to the panel on the interdisciplinary science of visual analytics. As most of you know, if you've read Illuminating the Path or been to any of the websites, visual analytics was defined as the science of analytical reasoning facilitated by the interactive visual interface. And we're going to try to unpack that a bit in this panel. And so I'll introduce my colleagues at the end, but they come from perceptual sciences, from cognitive science, as well as some familiar figures from the visual analytics community who have incorporated some of the cognitive perceptual principles into the work that they do and are often collaborating with cognitive scientists. So again, from Illuminating the Path, the group that set out this research agenda set a pretty high standard that the science of visual analytics has integrated perceptual and cognitive theories that embrace dynamic interaction between cognition, perception, and action, provides insight on fundamental cognitive concepts such as attention and memory, builds basic knowledge about the psychological foundations of meaning, flow, confidence, and abstraction. So we have lofty goals, and kind of in the spirit of the Grand Challenges panel, we've started salting in a few quotes. One of my favorites is from Sir Peter Medawar, philosopher of science. If politics is the art of the possible, research is surely the art of the soluble. They're both immensely practical-minded affairs. So our goals here are, on one hand, to uncover knowledge about these fundamental concepts, and on the other, to do it in a sense that it's practical and, one might argue, applicable. In order to do this, of course, visual analytics was set up to be a broadly interdisciplinary effort, and I have another quotation, Abelson on universities, society has problems and universities have departments. My last quote follows from the second one. Most advances come in science come when a person, for one reason or another, is forced to change fields. So what sparked a lot of my interest in returning to my scientific roots was that I had been working with UBC's Media and Graphics Interdisciplinary Center, and we found that we do a lot of industry contracts. We found that a lot of our industry partners were coming up with questions that were thinly veiled scientific questions. They required some basic knowledge. So General Motors was interested in perceptual distortion in stereo, shutter glass stereo, cave-like environments. They found it different kinds of perceptual effects for different individuals, which was really puzzling. And they needed to know whether there was something fundamentally wrong with what they were doing and whether they should continue to invest in caves. Dave Kasich, who's been in this community from the onset at Boeing, who we've worked with for some time, and they're interested in using this data in a collaborative sense across more applications in the environment. So there are problems with the perceptual abilities of a more diverse user population, and these are scientific questions. So in 7 minutes, I don't really have time to display my data. I encourage anyone who's interested to ask about the data during the question period, because I have plenty. But the research approach in my individual lab begins with structured qualitative field work. And so it's structured in the sense that I want to bridge to the laboratory. So we do work with the users, with their situation of use, we examine the organization, but the point is to drill down to these underlying cognitive, perceptual, cognitive operations. We do that by decomposing the task, but we don't decompose it into submodules of tasks. We decompose it into aspects of the cognitive neuroscience, so the sort of modularity of processing, if you will, that characterize human cognitive architecture, the structure of how we perform these tasks. We identify interaction challenges. These novel environments we create often challenge the way our brains work in some interesting ways. And you saw some foreshadowing of this in the keynote for the visualization conference from Margaret Livingston gave. We then devise toy world tests of just that specific module's robustness to challenge. So my analogy for this comes from the world of medical science. I actually began my research career in a biophysics lab in a medical school. And we would work with really reduced systems, but we would work with physicians who worked with clinical populations. They would come into the lab, do laboratory research, go back to the clinical setting. There was this ecology that included clinicians, clinical researchers, and laboratory researchers, and they all managed to communicate in a way that, you know, it wasn't perfect, but they at least had those models. So we try to take our things into the lab in the same way that I might have taken questions of cystic fibrosis that funded our lab, and looked at, you know, electron transfer, or rather electrolyte transport in small intestines of rats. So we do use-inspired basic research, and this draws from the Pasteur's quadrant work that many of you are familiar with, Donald Stokes' book, on human technology as a cognitive system. And we model the data whenever possible to try to build that applicability, to make our science a practical affair. So how do we do that? In my laboratory, is mostly an applied cognitive science, if I can say that, or an interaction science laboratory. But my school is the School of Interactive Arts and Technology. We have graphic and interaction designers who are right next door, so we have the ability to access the knowledge that they can bring. We do a lot of collaboration with information systems, with visualization researchers. There's a strong thread of that at UBC and at SFU, which are the two partner universities in our research effort. And we work also with the mathematics and the statistics people, mainly through the Institute for Research in Mathematics and Computational Science at Simon Fraser University. So it's this broadly interdisciplinary approach. It's very much along the lines of what Jim Thomas always talks about, of inviting these people to the table. And in the middle is something very interesting. There is this place in which the graphic and interaction designers with a design school or art background meet with the cognitive scientists who understand in very different ways how people perceive and think and act, information system designers, and the mathematicians and statistical experts. And that process in the middle is an increasing part of our effort, and coming from an interdisciplinary school, we're sort of prepared to address that. And we've made a few discoveries about interdisciplinary collaboration. The first is a quote from Chesterton, don't ever take a fence down until you know the reason it was put up. So there are often good reasons that these groups have talked to each other, and the effort to bridge that gap can be one that is pretty challenging. However, I want to end on a positive note and pass it over to my colleagues. Chesterton has another quote on adventure. Adventure isn't only an inconvenience rightly considered. An inconvenience is an adventure wrongly considered. So this effort is, we like to view it as an adventure. So that's it for me. I'll be coming back later to give a couple of slides and to guide some questions. Ronald Rensick will follow. His talk will deal with visual analytics and visual intelligence. Then Dave Ebert, who you all know, extending graphics and visualization to visual analysis. Bill Rabarski, visual thinking and thinking about visualization. And finally, Wayne Gray will talk about an integrated cognitive approach to advanced research on visual analytics. So we have about 30 seconds for questions. So if there's no questions, we'll roll. And we have had an extended question period at the end, which we hope to get a lot of audience interaction. So I hope you stick around and that we get some good discussion going. Any quick ones for me? Great. Then we'll pass it over to Ron.
Okay, great. Yeah, okay, great. Thank you. So it's great to be here to give you a couple of my thoughts on how a science of visual analytics might go and how interdisciplinarity might fit into that. So I think, as you all know, the real challenge for this area of research is to allow people to make sense of a huge amount of data, and also to do this really quickly. And there's different emphases you can put on it, but I think these are the two pillars of the visual analytics effort. So what we have is typically the systems that now exist use vision, really. You've got great visual interfaces, you've got a lot of nice graphics going on, some interaction. And the key thing in all of this, hence the name visual, right, is that we use vision to do the interaction with. And so if we believe this, where does this go in the long run? Now, as it stands, there's a nice definition of visual analytics, which is in the from Illuminating the Path, right? I think most of you know it. I have a slightly different perspective, which may be slightly more illuminating. Don't know. It depend on your background. But I like to think of visual analytics as a way of combining the strengths of human and machine intelligence to create, in some sense, these combined systems where we have the best of both. And the glue that holds all this together, the interface, as it were, is visual interaction. Not so much visual interfaces per se, but visual interaction. I like to actually expand to the activity itself. And what I mean by this is if we think of it along sort of along this line, on one hand, we've got the high-level thinking that we all know and love. At the low level, we've got, or the other level, we've got the machines doing what they all know and love. And in the middle, we've got the thing that holds them together is this visual interaction, where we have the machines create graphic representations, and we then base our visualizations upon that. So in my mind, this is the middleman, as it were. It's the key thing to make the whole thing work. The machines can be really, really smart, and we, arguably, in some cases, are very, very smart. But how do you actually connect the two in an optimal or at least a reasonably effective way? So let's take a look at what this means, visual and interaction. So what we have here, we can start at the beginning with data structures going off to a screen, right? Classic computer graphics, HCI. We then transmit, right? This part's actually science. It's called optics. Been a science for several centuries now, so that's not the hard part. The other hard part, though, is after that, it hits the eye and somehow ends up as high-level concepts. People thinking, they're seeing something and making sense of it. And there is an emerging area called vision science, which has been designed to study how this goes. Now, of course, this is visual interaction, so there's an interactive component, but I think I'll let some of the other panelists talk about that. What I like to do is to focus on this forward pipeline. All right, there's the two parts. There's the graphics and vision, both sort of loosely speaking. And the real question is, with an efficient combination. Remember that with a partnership, you're only as fast or as good as the weakest link. So where is this weakest link? Where is the rate-limiting step? Historically, it's been in the creation of graphic representations. It's been the algorithms that are scalable, can run real-time, all of these things. But more and more, that's shifting. And what we're finding is we can create a lot of cool representations, but the rate-limiting step is for the human to take those and make sense out of them. So effectively, this more and more is becoming the problem area. And the way to handle this, keep in mind that we can change the machine side of it, right? You can always program, create new algorithms. Not so much with this part, right? It doesn't evolve that fast. If you wait a million years or two, perhaps, but you're basically stuck with this thing that's kind of like a five-year-old. A very intelligent five-year-old that can do amazing things, but it's limited. It's not necessarily that flexible. So if you were to work with such a five-year-old, what you'd have to do, right, is you could, you know, write a book. You can speak to it as an adult. But what you want to do is to speak to it on its terms. To really have a good partnership going, you've got to sort of get into its mindset and talk to it in terms of how it understands the world. And then you've got an effective partnership. So I would argue that you have to do the same thing here. We have to learn how that five-year-old, this inner idiot savant, how it works and how we can work best with it. It's not like we're Mr. Potato Head here, right? With visual intelligence, there's particular ways that the system works. You have to realize that it's incredibly bright in some ways and incredibly not bright in others. It's been evolved to handle particular challenges. So clearly, I think you know, a lot of our high-level reasoning is actually visual in nature. All these visual metaphors are not an accident. There's a good story can be made that high-level intelligence evolved from the lower-level visual intelligences. So clearly we have to know what kinds of things count, like what are the natural modes that we have. Another point is that the low-level operations themselves are very, very smart. They can pick out patterns like nobody's business. They can do all kinds of things, and we really should try to take advantage of that and have the lower levels do as much as they can. So the point being then, in the design of visual analytics systems, we have to consider not just how we're getting it, not just the algorithms from the data structure to the graphical output, but what we're showing. These things have to be designed so as to fit into at least one or two of these slots, these aspects. Now, in terms of some examples of the intelligence, visual intelligence, a simple one, right, is grouping, helps you spot correlations. You also can do grouping on the basis of color, so you can get not only correlations, but you can detect different populations. This is all taking advantage of this low-level visual intelligence that most people aren't even aware of. More generally, you can study grouping. It's been done in vision science for about 100 years now. So we know all about this. And for grouping, it's done not only just through color. You can do it through orientation. In fact, what you can do is there are a whole set of what are called visual features, right, which include all of these and notice, et cetera. There's even more. And so one of the things is that I think visual analytics people typically right now are using a very reduced subset of this. And I would argue that there needs to be more interaction with the vision science community to find out what other options there are. All of these things and others can be used under the right conditions. They all have this ability of being computed very, very quickly, in parallel, without real conscious attention. And this whole thing is called early vision. So one point, you might think, well, I know all this stuff, but really, there's a lot of counterintuitive things going on, even at this level. So if I gave you this and said, okay, find the texture boundary, well, there's T's on one side and L's on the other, but the boundary is right there. Right? Not so easy to spot. And the idea there being that this low-level system is very intelligent in some ways. It can do this grouping, but it cannot do grouping on the combination of basic features. So both sides have horizontal and vertical lines, but the combination is something this system cannot do. So we have to be aware of the strengths and weaknesses of these systems. Another example here is a thing I think a lot of you have seen. Anybody, what I'm doing here is alternating between an original and a changed image. Anybody not see the change? Is there, raise your hand if you don't see what's changing? Or does everybody see it? Okay, yeah. So I guess some of you have seen demos of this sort before. So what you can do, in fact, in this case, the changing item is the engine in the middle. And if you know what it is, you can send your attention to it and see the change right away. But if you don't, you can spend a lot of time looking around. Here's one that's a little bit less famous. So you can see if you can, now that you're all warmed up, see if you can see the change quickly now. And probably not. This change is at least as big as the other. And can anybody still not see it, or can I move on? Still don't see it? Okay. So, yeah, so that's why this is called change blindness. Everybody pretty much has this. Again, the idea is that you need attention to see change. Until you attend, you're just seeing stuff go by. And that once you see it, in this example, it's the reflection in the rear window of the car on the right-hand side. Okay, see it's dark, white, dark, reflected. Okay, once you send your attention there, you'll see it right away. So the thing is, this effect is actually counterintuitive to a lot of people, or at least it was to me when I first encountered it, and I'm the guy that came up with it. So the thing is, we actually move our attention around really quickly in everyday life. That's the reason we don't sort of get, you know, run over by cars, is we have a certain amount of intelligence that tells us where to send our attention when. This is one of the keys to interactivity. We really have a virtual system that is inside our head. And so management is one of the key aspects of visual intelligence. In fact, more generally, what we have is visual intelligence to use all kinds of things, organization, learning, management, we saw attention, guidance, all kinds of things. So I would really urge that you consider finding out what scientists already have learned about this. I think it's extremely valuable. There's no sense reinventing the wheel. And yeah, the intuition, in fact, is not always going to get you there. So finally, questions, which I think Brian asked for. So first question is, to do this right, to design effective visual analytics systems, you want to know what forms of visual intelligence are out there, when they work, when they don't, all of this. Another question is, if you do have a given problem, how can you best map it to these sets of operations? And what I find is actually, it's very analogous actually to a compiler design program where you're trying to sort of, you've got a target language and you're trying to compile this thing down to a different set of operations. And I don't think this is accidental. I think this actually is a useful line of research for the future. And finally, the last thing I'd like to point out is the switching costs, this issue of switching costs. Again, it's another area where your intuition fails. There's severe costs every time you switch between different tasks. And I think in for practical systems, this will also be something to contend with. So I think I'll just leave it at that and take questions later. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I'm not a cognitive psychologist, but I was asked to be on the panel anyway. So what I wanted to do is sort of give you the perspective of why I think it's so important, and I think it really starts with what I consider to be a collection of the bases of visual analytic solution, that you really need to bring in a lot of rich visual media communication expertise and understanding of the what these people do up here and what they can bring. And so all of this needs to come together if you're going to create solutions for, depending on who you talk to, either hard problems, or some people said earlier this week, we should be spending our time and make more money on very simple problems. But in either case, There's a lot that can be done if you develop the right solution for this, and I think it really does have a lot of things. Now, another way of looking at this is sort of how do you relate the fields of study to visual analytics? And in both of these, you'll see interaction, you'll see cognitive and perceptual sciences, very important key factors to really bringing correct solutions. And I think another thing to think of is why you need this also is that visual analytics has a diverse area of applications. It's pretty much limitless in my perspective, but you may disagree. And in doing this, you really need to, this gets back to the title of the panel, the interdisciplinary nature of what we're trying to do here, in that you need to work with people from a large number of fields to bring this in together. So, you know, we currently in projects that we have going on, we have people that we collaborate with from cognitive psychologists to more traditional computer science and database people, statisticians, signal processing people, emergency response, biologists, a lot of different scientific applications, epidemiologists, public safety, and even swine veterinarians. So we do have quite a big, diverse group of people that we're working with in there, and I think that really shows that the cases where we've helped people solve problems, it has been an interdisciplinary team that's worked together, starting with some basic principles from cognitive science of you start out by first doing a task analysis of what's going on, how do people solve the problems. Then the computer scientists come in from the standpoint of how do we take the way that they solve this and come up with a computerized interface that actually forms a nice marriage between what the user's doing and what the computer's doing. And so, you know, some examples of what we're doing here, just to give you an idea that you can see, if you start with real-world problems, you come up with very good solutions. We do things like syndromic surveillance, in-field emergency response, pandemic preparedness applications there. We work with atmospheric scientists who are trying to understand very complicated, multi-scale, temporal varying data sets in multiple dimensions that they're all trying to integrate together. And then, yes, we do work with veterinary health professionals. So we have a lot of different clients, and luckily I do more time looking at clouds than I do visiting swine farms, so I've never had the pleasure. So that sort of brings, you know, if you look at the diversity of techniques that need to come together, if you look at the type of solution you're trying to do, which is looking at a way to help people make better decisions, I think cognitive science makes a lot of sense. So when I was trying to think why we should be looking at cognitive science, I came up with about three reasons. The first is, with the people on this panel, cognitive scientists really can be fun. You know, the more time you spend with them, the more you realize that. Secondly, they use really cool terms. I mean, in writing something up with Brian, someone who was reading it to revise it, actually said, this term I've never heard of before. I did a Google search and came up with zero hits. What is he talking about? So that was the first time that I had someone actually say that they couldn't find what this was by doing a web search. So, you know, maybe it was just something Brian invented the night before or had so many typos we couldn't find it. But really, I think the reason that you need to do this is really just the fact that for these to be used, they have to be designed for a user to incorporate them into the way they solve problems. And I think the user really is the key to all of this. And that's where I think if you start looking at the essential features of visual analytics, that really gets at the point of where the user comes in and why cognitive psychology and cognitive science is so important. Now, I think of visual analytics as being interactive, integrated decision-making and discovery environments. And so how do you create this interactive environment? It needs to be user-guided and perceptually guided to actually allow people to get amplification of their effort in doing this. And you've got this sort of nice balance going on between human cognition and automated computerized analysis. So if your goal is to try to do that and you don't talk to these colleagues up here or others that you have at your own school, and occasionally you can even get people who have psychology degrees and electrical engineering degrees, and then they're really great to talk to because there's no communication barrier. But, you know, even without it, you can learn a lot of things that we really need to take this into consideration. And if you're trying to figure out how visually you can create an environment that someone can make decisions and discoveries and then come up with quantitative, reliable, reproducible evidence without the types of things on how your visual perception system works, how do you know if people are going to get the right numerical value off of that plot that you got? Are they going to be able to see that difference? Are they going to be able to do that without it? And they, if they can't reliably do this, they really don't want to use your tool. At least most people that we've talked to, in the end, after they found what they're looking for or they solved their problem, oftentimes they want a number, and they want to be able to prove how that number was derived, not that the pixel on the screen was red. That's why an epidemic's occurring. That doesn't really sell to the public, so, or to the health officials or anyone else if you're doing quarantine. So you really need all of this, and it's key to understand the visual interface for all of this. So the other thing, the other last point that I'll make about why this is so important is if you look at what are the research challenges in visual analytics, you'll see that you're developing solutions that you want to scale across devices for mobile applications and the ubiquity of mobile computing these days. You want to handle the scale of problems that people are dealing with that can be orders of magnitude in the types of both temporal and spatial scales that the problems are coming in. And, you know, I like the fact that I hadn't really thought of things in the terms of, you know, the scale of data. You hear petabyte, you hear exabyte, and the new one that I hadn't really considered before was zettabyte data sets. But, you know, it keeps on being more and more terms to think of bigger and bigger things. How do you allow someone to handle scale? You know, the human mind has some ways of doing it, and if you create the right representation, you enable someone to do a better job with doing this. And then just the fact that you're trying to integrate so many different things, if you allow the visual system to help with that integration, you can come up with a much more effective way of doing it. And then finally, you know, I think it's key for all of this, and that's really where, again, visual representations come in and the science behind it is, how do you adapt your solution so that it makes sense for the user who's using it, the given task that they have at hand, and the environment, whether they're sitting out in eastern Washington State around a campfire learning about visual analytics, or they're a first responder, or they're on a farm. You know, how do you create a representation that actually allows them to come up with a solution? You know, the environment is key. And that's really where a lot of this science comes into play. In a hands-busy, very stressful operation, you probably want a different display than you do if someone's going to spend hours pondering the visual you create. So these are the type of things that really need to be considered, and that's where, like, the sub-area of situational awareness comes in, and people who do a lot of work in that in crisis situations. So all of that can factor in, and it allows you to collaborate with really great people and bring new things in and hopefully come up with good solutions. So, thanks.
All right, my turn. All right, so let me talk a little bit about the challenge, because the challenge or problem is not just scale, it's in size, but in complexity. In fact, the reason we really need cognitive science and we need to work together is because of the complexity, the analytical complexity of the problems that we're involved with. So it's not just the amount of data. It's the fact that we have to reason through these problems. And there are a lot of problems. I think we can all come up with them. Here's just a few that I've and my group have been working on. Obviously, genomic analysis and the sorts of analysis, not only genomes, but proteomics, functional analysis, you have microarray analysis, you have not only all the genetic information, but you have the fact that you have millions and millions of annotations associated with them. This is not just like a pattern matching problem, it's an analytical problem to understand. Air quality simulations and analyses, the large scale air quality models have something like nearly 200 reacting
chemically reacting three-dimensional time-dependent fields. A huge amount of data, yes, but to understand those interactions and what's happening, and if you put down new sources of pollution, for example, what happens, is an analytical problem. Urban modeling and predictive modeling, you put things in, you have to associate with how the neighborhood wants to develop, what sort of constraints are on the neighborhood, all things like that. Financial transaction analysis. We and others have been doing a lot of work here. Again, a very complex analytical problem. Not only fraud, but risk analysis, investment analysis. Something that's a very deep investigative problem. Comprehensive customer analysis. Think Walmart. Think Home Depot. Think the banks. There's a real problem with big data warehouses and using them effectively for things like this. Complex investigative analysis, of course. This was one of the areas that motivated visual analytics. Storm surge and coastal infrastructure stress analysis. This is something we're just getting into. Very complex models where you have storm surges, where you have flooding, where you have effects on the infrastructure, on the buildings, on the bridges. Where you may have to have transportation models, where you have to preserve the critical infrastructures. All of this has to be analyzed together in order to get certainly preventive models. So you can put in your own applications for this sort of thing, for this complex analytical analysis. The other thing, Brian mentioned the science of visual analytics. And he had this quote from Karl Popper on what science was. So can we achieve a science in a Popperian sense, in the sense of Karl Popper? Not only models and theories, but a real understanding of what's inside and what's outside the science. And should we try anyway? Maybe we can, but is it worth trying? I think it is very much worth trying to build this sort of edifice. And we've had a discussion about this, a very lively discussion about this earlier in the week. But I think it's very useful. And the next thing is, should it be an interdisciplinary science? And, of course, I wouldn't be on the panel unless I wanted to be contrary, unless I believe that. But if we're talking about an interdisciplinary science, we're talking about something where we're both developing things together. We're not just reaching across the aisle, across the campus, to pull ideas from cognitive science. We're really trying to develop together a new science. What are the components here? Obviously, visual analytics, cognition, but in the center, and I put it there on purpose, interaction. It turns out that interaction, as much as visualization, is a very deep part of this, as you think of especially higher cognitive processes. And that's why we're trying to develop an interaction theory as part of this interdisciplinary science. Another very interesting question, if the true interdisciplinary science develops, will it be a new science? Maybe it won't be visualization and computer science-based or cognitive science-based, but it's something else. What have I discovered? Well, I've discovered cognition is everywhere. I'm like Molière's bourgeois gentilhomme, who was delighted that he had been speaking prose all his life. By golly, I've found that I've been doing cognitive analysis or something like it. And it's very useful to be thinking in this way because we're discovering that it's certainly in the interaction. And to understand the interaction in a cognitive sense is very important for approaching the types of tasks that we're trying to approach. It's certainly in the visual representations. We're trying to do something that we call knowledge visualization, where we're trying to make the artifacts pieces of knowledge rather than just pieces of data. It's in the design. So as we try to build our cognitive model, it actually informs how we design our visual analytics interfaces. It's in the visual and analyses processes for sure, because this is a complex reasoning process and has to be there. And it's in the evaluations. As we build these systems, we start to learn how to evaluate them cognitively, and that's very useful and important. So There are actually models that are being developed. Here's one that a lot of us are using, the sense-making model by Paroli and Card. It actually developed for task analysis, cognitive task analysis for intelligence analysts, but I think it's a much more general model and applies to any sort of investigative analysis. So very briefly, you have the foraging analysis loop at the bottom left and the sense-making loop, the hypothesis generation and testing loop at the top. So you have all these individual processes in between, evidence gathering and searching, and then using or discarding evidence or using evidence either to prove or discard hypotheses. And we're actually working on a couple of systems here in order to develop a capability for this sense-making loop and then a lot of visualization tools. But the thing I want to mention most here is all that looping that goes on, and that's where the interaction occurs. That's where the higher-level cognitive interaction occurs. And so that is very important. Another thing I want to say, it's been bugging me a lot, and I think it's going to confound what we do, is we got to be careful and detailed about our definitions. So I see all the time people talking about knowledge, information, and data, for example, interchangeably, and they're not. I think of knowledge as the ability to distinguish between ideas, two ideas, or facts. That's sort of a good basic definition, and that's different than information or data. And if we don't think that way, we're going to confound what we do. We're going to blur things. Another thing, we're working and we'll be submitting a short paper on insight. You know, the purpose of visualization is insight. So what's the definition of insight? Well, there's at least two main uses we found in the literature. One is what you might call spontaneous insight, the aha moments, you know, something that comes in a flash. And the other is knowledge-building insight. If you look at the neuroscience on this, they're very different. And so you will actually confound the two for if you don't separate them. Spontaneous insight, for example, can actually be suppressed if you're doing this sort of search and building task that you do in knowledge-building insight. On the other hand, maybe you need, and you will need, knowledge-building insight to prepare the playing field so you can have that spontaneous insight. There are also different types of knowledge. Two types that we're considering are tacit knowledge, what's inside the human, what's personalized, and then explicit knowledge, the stuff that's come out and is being shared. Obviously, the path is from tacit to explicit knowledge. So we have to keep those definitions separated if we're really going to start doing careful testing of our tools and of what we mean. What's in this all for the cognitive scientist? You know, we, the visual analysts, say, come on over, spend your time with us, spend your money with us. Well, here's one thing. Brian and I have been talking about the visual analytics can provide testable artifacts and models for complex reasoning applications to advance cognitive science. So the types of applications we're working on are more complicated than the ones that the cognitive scientists are used to testing. So now we're starting to do some of that testing, so we can actually give back, look inside that black box of the human mind in order to model and then test the human reasoning process so we can give things back. Thank you.
I'm going to stand up so I can see this half of the audience, which otherwise I can't see. Why am I? Oh, there they are. Can I be on this? Maybe. Okay. First, I want to thank Brian for organizing this panel, inviting me. Interesting, one of the themes of this panel seems to be that you may be a cognitive scientist and not know it. At Rensselaer, we have a place for people like that. We call it the Cognitive Science Department. These are not renamed cognitive psychologists, although that is what I happen to be. I have my degree in psychology from Berkeley, but one of my colleagues has his degree from MIT's Media Lab. Another has his degree from Caltech's Applied Mathematics Department. Another has his degree from Brandeis's Computer Science, and another one has his degree in philosophy from Brown. So all sorts of people wake up one day and realize they're cognitive scientists. My lab, we do research using a variety of techniques. We do lots of modeling, computational, mathematical, and statistical modeling, where we borrow lots of techniques from whoever we can borrow them from. We do lots of behavioral-type data collection, response times in milliseconds, eye fixations, performance times, and microgenetic analysis, which is looking at one person's behavior over a long period of time, sort of second by second, or millisecond by millisecond. And we've also been collecting neurobiological data, neurocognitive data lately, EEGs, fMRI, and we're collaborating with people doing fMRIs. So these are the various techniques we bring to bear. But Brian wanted me to tell you all about what we do and what's relevant for cognitive science in 7 minutes. So I've been throwing out slides all morning, so I'm not going to get very deep, but I will try to give a high-level perspective. And sometimes it helps to talk about these things in terms of two types of cognition, because we all live in, we're all aware of ourselves and think we're deep thinkers and whatnot. We're all somehow or another aware of our consciousness without realizing we're unaware of much what goes on. And some people talk about these two types of cognition, like a horse and rider, where in this case the rider's goals is to rope the cattle, and the horse's goals is to focus on HCI. Horse-cattle interaction. The rider's goals are strategic, long-term, global perspective, explicit. The horse's goals tend to be short-term, local, implicit, and very interested in conserving resources, in this case, not getting stepped on by the cattle. Right? The horse and rider is really analogous to the human cognitive system. Unfortunately for us, we're not system one. The cognitive horse is system one, not the one that we think of as system one. This is responsible for non-deliberate thought and it's about 90% of cognition. System two is the 10%, the tip of the iceberg. This is the rider, what we think of as the rider. It's hard to know who's in control, right? The horse or the rider, right? Horse is much bigger. The evolutionary, neuroscientist John Allen likes to talk about these things in terms of evolutionary inertia. Evolution sort of progresses by overlaying new technologies on older substrates, and the older substrates are still there. Okay. Now, this is important for visual analytics when we start thinking about design versus functionality, because the writer is the one focused on achieving higher level goals, and it's the customer for software functionality. You know, you buy something because you want what it does for you, what it can do. It's really neat. Or you buy for your organization, or you start that line of research because you really want these sorts of outcomes. However, the horse is focused on minimizing resources over the next one-third to 30 seconds. The horse takes a very, you know, local view of things. And the horse basically should be the customer for software design and often is not. The issue is when design and functionality are out of alignment, the horse will lead the rider to stable but suboptimal. I'm going to pull this out, aren't I? Suboptimal performance, and the rider will usually be unaware that this is occurring. Now, it's not that the rider can't avoid this situation; it's just that, you know, controlling every movement your horse makes requires a lot of attention and control, and takes your attention away from the problems you're trying to solve that you got the software for in the first place. Okay. It increases cognitive workload and all these other sorts of interesting things. So one of the goals of cognitive science in this visual analytic mix is to bring design in line with functionality so that the cognitive horse and rider work together as one system that maximizes the use of the available cognitive, perceptual, and action resources. So I think of these things. Everybody has to try it, and this is very much like the three things Dave was talking about. We have behavior and service of a given task and given task environment. And this requires the interaction of the human mind with the external world via perception, action, and of course cognition. And all three of these things are needed to, you know, optimize interaction and active behavior and to design interactions. A lot of what I do, I'm already mentioned, is 1/3 to 3-second time level. This is not just an arbitrary number I picked out. We actually gave a paper about this at Cognitive Science last summer. But a lot of people have focused on this 1/3 to 3-second time level as being something unique. The German neurophysiologist Popper calls this the subjective moment. William James actually called it the subjective moment, and Popper has resurrected this. Al Newell referred to this as a time span of immediate behavior. Interesting enough, a lot of the decisions we make, even in information search tests, take place about this time frame. A large-scale study of web use showed that the modal web page was looked at for like 2 seconds. As a cognitive scientist, I'd like to know what the heck did people gain in that 2 seconds, which made them decide this was the wrong place to be and hit the back key or hit a link or something of this sort. And was this the correct decision? Or was it merely the operation of penny-wise, pound-foolish cognitive controller of a poorly designed web page? Lots of behavior happens at 1/3 to 3 seconds, and lots of visual interfaces are being constructed for people like UAV pilots who have to make these decisions about that time stage. You do this when you're driving in traffic. If you took much more than 1/3 to 3 seconds to make a decision while you're driving in traffic, you'd be dead. You wouldn't be here, right? Video game players do this all the time. Most of everyday decision making takes about 1/3 to 3 seconds to make. This is maybe a little disappointing to some of us, but this is what we do. And when you're doing something like skiing, again, you know, you do some planning, but once you start going, you're making decisions about every 1/3 to 3 seconds. I want to show you some of what can happen in 2 seconds and how we can analyze it by showing you a movie that's not mine, but from Laurette Itty's lab at USC. On the left, you see a movie clip. On the right, we see the same movie clip overlaid with eye fixations, on the center, rather. And on the right, what you'll be seeing is a statistical analysis of the visual saliency, visually most salient aspects of that movie clip, and there'll be the things in bright. Now, this is an algorithm that's based upon what the lower visual cortex responds to when visual stimuli hit it, okay? And this was developed by Laurent Itty, and it's very similar to a lot of visual saliency algorithms. So the question is, where are people looking when they look at these video clips that jump? So the center, again, you see the eye fixations, and the right you see the bright and shiny things, which are the visually salient parts of that screen. Now, most of us hopefully don't spend too much of our day staring at 2.5-second video clips or 3 seconds, whatever they are. But the real question is, you know, what is being attended to? The bright and shiny bits or the informationally important ones, right? Where does the eye want to look? Laurent shows us that over the course of 3 seconds, that answer changes. When you first get a new clip, you're drawn to the bright and shiny bits. You should be looking at the blue curve, not the bars. I can tell you about that in questions if we have time. But over the course of about 2.5 seconds, the eye starts picking up information about what's going on, starts attending to things which are more informationally relevant. Towards the end of that, however, these are dynamic things. So what was informationally relevant at the beginning of the clip, 2 seconds later, is no longer there. So the eye is back to looking at bright and shiny things. And the real question is, are the bright and shiny things on your visual interface the, you know, neat stuff, the important stuff, or are they just sort of the bright and shiny, you know, bits which don't really attract your eye to anything important? So where do you look in 2 seconds, and what decisions do you make? When you look at something like that, or that, or that, or a web page, or an award-winning interface, all these things have lots of bright and shiny bits. Are they where you want to look for the information that you want? So, again, I think I'm about ready to sit down, but basically the bottom line here is that you really need to think about interaction from a much more global perspective, from the perspective of cognition, perception, as well as action, and from this 1/3 to 3-second level where the bottom-up stuff and the top-down stuff is sort of interacting. We know why we go to these complex visual analytic interfaces to solve a certain sort of information processing problem. The question is, have we really solved that problem? And who solved the problem? Has the designer unknowingly built in certain biases that the user unknowingly falls prey to? So, you know, who's in control? The user who's actually using the interface, or is their cognitive horse being subtly biased by a designer who wasn't even clear that he or she was biasing the horse that way versus another when they were designing the system? Okay, and Brian asked us to give some questions, and my three questions would be, do milliseconds really matter? This low-level stuff really matter in real life? Why aren't simple empirical approaches such as try and test enough? You know, why can't you just run people through usability testing in the cycles? Why do you need to resort to cognitive modeling and this level of analysis? And maybe we haven't convinced you that theories of cognitive control really have much to do with visual analytics, so you might raise those issues as well. Thank you.
So I'm not going to spend much time here. I'm just going to set the stage what I hope will be a lot of interesting discussion. What you see here is, you know, this group that involves science, in the cognitive science sense. We've got colleagues who've been working in the computer science world, visualization. There's a synergy of science and design. One of the things that I want to draw attention to in just a couple of slides, there are ways in which the work that I do and that Ron does and that Wayne does have been fundamentally changed by these interactive technologies. We're still cognitive scientists, I think, but we're cognitive scientists that examine the novel kinds of perceptual and interactive situations that happen when we create our own environment. We have all sorts of data that shows that these changes in the environment change fundamentally some of the ways in which we interact with them. This is complex. It's a new field. It may be a new science. I don't think it can be done by training computer scientists in cognitive science, although that's a very good thing to do. I think we need to have some of this as Jim talks about, this body contact between disciplines. In our group, we take a look at building a science of interaction, and that will give us the ability to design for these key aspects of the human cognitive architecture that are threatened by the things we do. It gives us specific litmus tests for those aspects of interaction, not just summative user performance, but formative tests about how this affects your ability to perform attentional operations, to parse a visual scene. Now, what does this do for the design world? At this point, you know, we're not going to design your interfaces for you. We're about the level in medical community was in the day of Paul Ehrlich. He knew enough chemistry, but not a lot of biochemistry didn't exist. So he used the science of the day to reduce his design space. He was seeking the first antibiotic, effectively, for tuberculosis. He had a testing model, and he only had to test 606 different interfaces before he found one that worked. So it's incremental progress, but it's progress. And today, and I started my career in a biophysics lab, medical science is clearly a distributed cognition. They have recognized that a physician can't know everything about the science that impacts our health. There are clinicians, biochemists, biophysicists, there are clinical researchers. Many of them will never be first author. They are involved in these cross-disciplinary and multi-person activities that advance health. So where would I like to see the science be? I will feel that we have succeeded when we create one native theory of cognition, and this may be phrased as a question for my questions. Do we have a native theory of cognition facilitated by the interactive visual interface? Not ported from psychology, but informed by it certainly, specific to the kinds of tasks and systems we create. And then I want to see it die. I want to see a theory falsified by experiment, and this is Karl Popper coming back to haunt us. This idea that we will expose our theories to the rigorous test of empirical data and we'll let them die when it's appropriate for them to die. I would like to see us build, and we're beginning to do this, a cognitive architecture, a structure for sense-making that has those little modules in it. And that gives us a grain by which we can begin to explore those modules and tie down their characteristics, but it also gives us this possibility. You know, and it's been a holy grail for cognitive science since the days of Newell and Simon that we may be able to model cognition to the point of making predictions about complex behaviors and complex situations. And I'll conclude. We talked about pure science and applied science. It's kind of old habit, but I think all of us believe this line by Pasteur. My French accent is too bad to try to do it properly, but it translates as, you know, there's no such thing as a pure science, there's no such thing as an applied science. There's really only science and the applications of science as the tree and its fruit. So for that, I think we're open for questions.
Brian, I'll jump in. Lucy Nowell from the National Science Foundation. Thank you for what is likely the most important event of this conference, and to you and all of your panelists. I really think you've done some fine things here. I want to weigh in with some observations about users of analytic systems and come back to some points you touched on that and some that I think might be missing. Users of visual analytic systems are often time pressured. They're working against intense deadlines, and if they're first responders, they've got to decide very, very fast indeed. They're aware of consequences of errors, whether that's to push the button to fire a weapon, launch a nuclear device, invade a country, or just whether you tell people to stay put or run, knowing someone might die as a result of the guidance you give. Because of that, they're likely to be agitated or emotional, and that impacts the way they think. And some of the users, not professional analysts, but some users may not be very bright, or they may be approaching a field where they're not aware of enough information to count as a professional. So that brings us back to some issues in cognitive science that I think might need to come to the table. There's learning theory, especially as applied to adult learners as people approach a new discipline or analyze a new body of documents they haven't seen before. There's decision theory, not just for the analyst in deciding which documents to look at, but realizing that they're often enabling decisions by others, so they need to understand how to facilitate that. We need expertise in critical thinking because that's really an enormous part of what analysis is about, and that also engages logicians. And finally, analysis is ultimately about communicating to another population, and we don't have a communications expert here. And finally, just one comment, Ron, as you look at encouraging people to look at using more of those graphical devices, I'll tell you based on my own research that when you get beyond 3 non-redundant encodings, our error rate skyrockets. Be careful.
These are all really juicy questions for cognitive science. The interesting thing is for each of those points you brought up, and I'll let my colleagues jump in, I know research that is close but is not on. We expect cognitive scientists to answer questions that have not been posed to them. What they do is they work in areas that are of interest to them. But, you know, when you talk about the communication, collaboration stuff, you know, we've had some research in how people coordinate. Actually, my partner did her dissertation studying how musical performers coordinate their interaction in playing, learning how to play a piece. How they understand the piece, how they negotiate meaning, how they negotiate entry and exit in an improvisational piece. That kind of real-time, certainly time-pressured, there's a lot of pressure when there's two people on stage performing for a large audience. It's not the same as launching a nuclear device bombing a country, but I imagine those heart rates are pretty high. So there's people who look at this, but they don't look at it at all in this context because they simply don't know these problems exist.
Yeah, as Brian says, this is a real good example of why having these real, you know, practical to some sense, but also very important application challenges really focus us and tell us what's going to be important. And often it is not what our discipline is on top of. And so this is another reason for an interdisciplinary science that moves us off of our comfort spots. And you can see with questions like that why this is the sort of science that you know, not only us but our students and their students will be working on for some time.
Yeah, just a few things if I could. At one point, I never know whether I should be the cognitive scientist. And people sometimes look at me when we have these kind of panels, and I'm actually a computer scientist that ended up working on interfaces for Nissan for many years. So even though I came up with some of these things, and psychologists think, you know, some of my stuff's cool, I'm not really a psychologist. I do stuff that's relevant to them. They seem to like it. So, but it's very much problem-driven. The stuff with change blindness, the stuff I did, I did it in response to, you know, why is inattention a problem in car accidents? Why does it cause this? So a lot of the work, even a lot of good basic science, can stem from these practical phenomena people come across. So this thing about, you're talking about these redundant, you know, the multiple redundancies can cause problems. That'd be a great thing to follow up on, find out why, because current theory says that shouldn't happen, and this is the sort of way I advocate doing a lot of research. So this just, I want to make this clear, is very much in this bi-directional thing that you can use the science to help design, but you can also take a look at design problems or effects and go the other way, so it's very much back and forth. And for a lot of people, like I say myself, I'm really in the middle. I never know quite whether to call myself a perception person or not. I maybe should take a vote on it one day, but I personally have no idea. I just do my stuff. Anyway, the second point, actually, this is completely orthogonal, but I think it's important, is that one of the advantages of knowing a little bit about what goes on in humans is a lot of it is very contradictory to intuition. And also, we're getting a lot of progress on several fronts. And you were talking about time pressures. So this connects to the stuff that Wayne was talking about, the sort of the two systems. There's the conscious mind, and then I usually call it the inner zombie, this other thing, or if you like, the horse. It turns out that system has a great deal of intelligence, most of which we don't appreciate it because we never really are aware of it. And one of the things is that the conscious mind typically thinks that more conscious thought's better. And it turns out sometimes if you think too much, you can be worse off. So part of the art, this will be a future challenge, is to sort of when to, you know, go with the conscious mind and when to let this other system do its thing. There really are situations where too much conscious thinking about things actually causes you to go into suboptimal performance. So this is just another example of the kind of things you can become aware of, and I think this is good to at least, you know, get some familiarity with people who work in this area, because there's some really cool stuff out there.
I'm George Grinstein from UMass Lowell. I got up initially to correct the translation, and now there's a whole bunch of things that have been said that sort of reinforce what Pasteur said. What he's saying is that there is a science. However, there are not many, there's not one science that you can say is an applied science. And his end is saying that the science really comes from applications which are the fruits of the tree. And the fruits of the tree are the applications. And so, in effect, whenever you do a little experiment in whatever area, whether it's a cognitive area, whether it's an algorithm area, etc., you're helping build the science. And as you pointed out, it reverses itself. You could actually take the science and then make some predictions to see where it goes. It is a bidirectional activity. It is imperative that we start thinking all the way through of a science, because without that, you have fruits on the tree and you have no idea what to do in terms of their future generation. And they are building this science, and we have to harness the fact that we got some terrific, terrific work that's been done over the last 10 years, and you folks are continuing work, but we need to put it a little together. And there are models, lots of models that have been proposed that people are thinking, so it's not like we're not doing it. But I think we need to look at it much, much more from the broader aspect, all the way into the cognitions, which has limits. Probably the most limiting aspect is our brain.
Yeah, thanks for the aid in translation and for your comments. What we've found is, and the paper, I won't go into it because I don't want to get into philosophy of science debate, but when I teach in an interdisciplinary school. I've got students who come from the sciences, from the computing sciences, from social sciences, from the arts. It's very interdisciplinary, and these questions of philosophy of science really come up. If you read, you know, Lakatos or some of the philosophers of science, you'll find that their notion of science is science happens at the grain of the scientific community. It doesn't happen at the grain of the individual. And so Einstein is a scientist. He never did a study. Neither did Darwin. But because they were part of a community that accepted this notion of falsifiability as a, you know, the key way by which they discover what truth is, then they are scientists. They're part of that. And I think we do get into this notion of who's a scientist and who's not, which is not very productive. The other thing that, in terms of my work, and it kind of gets back to something Lucy said, as we began to examine performance in these different domains, what we found was that individual differences become hugely important, much more so, and I've got all this lovely data, but I won't show it, than if you look at a performance in the physical world or performance in a very reduced Q environment that we use in our laboratory tests. So what we hope to do, if we ever do develop our cognitive architecture, and we're beginning to do in the modules, is to develop these kinds of personal equations that allow us to tune our model to predict individual performance. We can do it in small ways, but hopefully that's a way that we can begin to move towards saying what will happen when you're under stress, and we have a way of understanding how the interface can at least attempt to compensate.
I'd like to riff off your comment that our limitation is the brain, and of course I don't suppose I could argue that the brain isn't one of our limitations, but one of the interesting things is nowadays we can do all sorts of things to a visual interface that we couldn't do 30 years ago, or even 5 years ago, and the question is how many of these things can we do which are good, which actually aid understanding or not. So for example, a very common thing to do, because we can do it and it's easy now and it looks really cool, is design all these three-dimensional interfaces. A colleague of mine, Harvey Smallman, who some of you may know, a perceptual psychologist, used to be at San Diego, I think he's now at Sandia Lab, he was in a position where all the Navy admirals were coming to his group saying, we want these cool-looking 3D interfaces for the systems that are going to be aboard our ship or the ones where we're building for our guys. And Harvey said, well, you know, his guys could build those systems, but he started noticing that 3D interfaces, people were systematically underestimating ranges, and this was a range-finding test, so they wanted this really cool thing, and they were much better at estimating ranges and distances with a flat, you know, God's eye perspective, where everything's just two-dimensional and flat, just because of the characteristics of the human perceptual system versus the characteristics of the display. And there's lots of things like that we just don't know. Maybe they look really cool, maybe because they're hyper-real, like the... forgetting the right analogy, but you know, some things look so cool, we're just very much attracted to that because it corresponds to something in our evolutionary background that was important, but we just take that essence and over-distill it. There's some phenomena with a type of bird whose name I'm forgetting, which really likes the color red, and it will peck at that color red, usually in order to mate, but you can make this thing more red than real for the bird, it will peck at that false color preferentially, and obviously not do the species any good at all. So there's all sorts of interesting issues like that. We're just beginning to understand how these things that we can do and maybe think look really cool may not be the best solutions for problems that we actually have.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, just like in all our other applications and our interfaces for them, they should be appropriate for the task. And in this case, perhaps it's the cognitive task. But if we just stop to follow up on what George said, if we just stop at the task analysis, it's like in this metaphor, taking fruit and picking it off the tree and forgetting about the rest of the tree. This process of modeling, especially predictive modeling, is what is very important. It's very important to organize our thoughts and to tell us the directions to go and to give us an ability to make interfaces that are well beyond anything that you could make if you just did task analysis and evaluations. If you have a chance, talk with Stuckart about the development of their interface model, something that was for the WIMP interface in terms of the GOMS model and how important that was, that predictive model was, in order to be able to lay out their interfaces.
And on that note, I have to get up again. Because I would argue that one of the biggest challenges for human-computer interaction as a whole, and certainly for visual analytic science and technology, is that we do not have a science of task analysis that results in anything that is repeatable. Each and every designer I know wants to do their own task analysis of the same subjects. And until we have repeatability in task analysis, we're talking black art. So I, in one of my capacities at NSF, I have actually put that on a national research agenda, that we must do the science to develop repeatability in task analysis.
Yeah, I mean, at some level, it's, you know, it's great to be in a time when quotes from Louis Pasteur are relevant, because we're at the beginning of a very important effort to take technology seriously. And when you take technology seriously, you understand that its goal is frequently something that happens between someone's ears. It's something that will succeed or fail based upon, you know, that understanding. And it really does shift us into that human realm. I keep coming back to medicine because they've dealt with very hard problems that really matter for a long time. And they don't have a perfect system, but they do have a system that has done pretty well at addressing the incredible complexity of human health, of the body. And I think we'd do well to take a look at how they've managed to distribute their tasks. I never saw a clinician who had contempt for pure science in working in a medical lab. And I don't think I've ever seen medical research. They prefer doing medical research, and they often prefer laboratory research, but they certainly didn't have contempt for the clinicians. They did have this ecology of mutual respect that really enabled them to move forward as a field, and I think there's something quite positive in that. I mean, we are, you know, at the point of recognizing, I think, that you know, we can no longer do, you know, feed mushrooms to 6 people and see whether they get better or not. This sort of summative testing is not getting us anywhere. Until we step back and develop some models, I think it's always going to be unreproducible.
Take this slide.
Sure.
Assuming this does go on. There you go. On what Lucy had to say about not reusing task analysis, it occurred to me recently, and this is a slide from another talk, actually, but it's perfect here. This is dance notation. It occurred to me recently that we really don't have a good notation for transcribing interaction, whether it's interaction with a computer or interaction with anything. And we started looking around for, well, who does this? And this is not by far the least popular dance notation, but there are other fields which have taken on this particular problem. How do you transcribe? How do you communicate interactive behavior? And it's something which I actually think we need some focus on as both for cognitive science, visual analytics, and maybe lots of other interactive technological type fields.
Well, yeah, but that just scratches the surface, because we're talking about cognitive tasks here, and we really want, a notation that gets inside the head and says when are they working on this cognitive task, and what strategies are they using with respect to some other task, and when do they change? So we really need a lot more for that.
Well, yeah, what we've got really, I think, are two levels at least. One is just the behavior itself, qua behavior, as the philosophy types would say. And the other is the role of intention, what you're trying to do with that behavior. So I think you can actually separate, because there's many ways to achieve the same end, right? You could have the same intent to sort of grab a cup or something. You can have different behaviors. But to actually describe behavior itself has actually been, oddly enough, a great problem in the area of cognitive science. And again, it's one of these things, if you talk to some people, your friendly neighborhood, you know, cognitive person, buy them a few beers, after a while, they'll really say that's one of the sort of skeletons in the closet, is that nobody, as far as anyone knows how to describe behavior. Like even this goes back to behaviorists, you know, little rats, they would say, well, how would you describe when a rat was being trained for something? And they would always have to use intentional things like the rat is hungry, the rat wants to escape. But, you know, if you actually just said, well, how's the rat moving in space? Nobody's been able to do this. And, in fact, the closest that have been proposed are these dense notations, oddly enough. And it's a great scandal of sorts in that area. So I think there's clearly some incredible potential here. I'm not sure how much of it is, you know, going to be immediately relevant here. But in the long run, it's certainly an important area, important issue.
Paul Brewster from NASA Langley. I had a question for you guys. I've been in visualization for a while, but this week's my first week with visual analytics, and I'm surprised that there's a field nobody has talked about yet that seems very pertinent to everything you're doing here, and that's the airplane pilots and air traffic controllers. For years, they've been doing much of this stuff you've been talking about, and they even have a whole category of analysis tools on cognitive load of an interface, and, you know, they have all the things you've been talking about, and I haven't heard mention all week of them. Can you talk about that?
I should dig up my data from the air traffic control studies. But yeah, no, we had a couple years of funding from HRL to look at air traffic control, and the difficulty is finding access to air traffic controllers and situations to test them. So we ended up doing what we usually do, which is to pull back into the laboratory to look at some of the modularity of performance in air traffic control. I think it's an audience in which I can say this. I find that there's more interesting stuff in some of the really focused human factors literature than I find in the HCI literature. And that there are situations in which people have really spent a lot of time on a difficult task. And that, I think, is a very good example. In our case, our problem with air traffic control was we were looking at the shift in display technology that will accompany the move to this free flight protocol where pilots have more autonomy. And we just decided to look at whether the changes in the display would place strain on a particular mechanism of perceptual attention. It's called the Finst hypothesis. It's work that underlies a bit of, you know, you can explain some of Ron's phenomena with this theory. They've referred back and forth to each other, I think. The interesting bit is it's a threat that could, in extremely small amount of cases, cause an accident. And there is an argument when they went back and looked at the U.S. Downing of a civilian jetliner during the first Iraqi war. One analysis of that was that this particular kind of misattribution of characteristics of one aircraft to another that happens when attentional tokens swap may have underlined that tragedy. We just wanted to raise the heat on that particular aspect of the cognitive architecture of air traffic control. And the argument was you can test summatively air traffic control. You can put people in a simulator and give them situations for 100 years before you will find enough of those that you can measure and determine the effect of other variables on them. Because it's not enough to say there's a problem. I have to know when I change something, does the problem go away? Does it get bigger? Does it get worse? That interaction effect is something we're always looking for. But by increasing the heat on that, by placing people in a very novel situation where the environment had a different task, it was a task that they have to do, a subtask in air traffic control, tracking multiple moving targets, a very complex display moving in ways that no airplane would move. The display itself moved in ways that no one would have a display move. And what we found was that people have an unexpected and unknown ability to do that particular task. The interesting bit about it was not only did it say that aspect of the air traffic control interface change was probably safe, but it also was interesting enough to psychology to be published in the highest impact journal in perceptual psychology, the Journal of Experimental Psychology, Human Perception and Performance. So we're finding places where we're doing science that scores very high in the science world, but I think it also says something about, in this case, air traffic control, that we couldn't have done with summative testing. We had to decompose. They use that reductionist model of science.
Can I add something?
Sure.
Yeah, I just want to add that my colleague Brian is very much an experimental and empiricist, and this is a strong area of the cognitive sciences broadly defined. But another area is the attempt to build unified theories of cognition, perception, and action, because what we really like to do is be able to get in front of these phenomena and build high-fidelity cognitive models that we can run on simulations of these new systems and run them on all possible permutations and run them all night tirelessly. So they will find these things, which only happen once out of every 1,000 or 10,000 times, because something like the air traffic control system, you know, something goes wrong once out of every 10,000 times. That's really unacceptable because there's too many planes up there right now. And you can't really find those sorts of things by, nobody can do that many empirical trials with a plane simulator with a live crew. I mean, the only real way to do that is either after the fact, which is the wrong time to do it, or by building very strong models which will be able to predict how humans will behave, how cognition will fail, things which are quite frankly beyond us right now, but that's the way that the field is trying to move.
Yeah, that's hugely important. When the cognitive sciences were formed, it was really that belief that we can create, we must model cognition to understand it. We can't understand it in a piecemeal fashion. And this came up in discussion with George, a paper we're both familiar with, a classic by Alan Newell. You can't play 20 questions with nature and expect to win. If you look at just inferential hypothesis testing, which is much still of experimental psychology, it can give you the pieces, and sometimes the pieces are critical, but to build the whole enables you to predict more complex task performance.
Yeah, one other thing, one of the reasons that this wasn't mentioned, because of course it's a very useful application area, sort of the super users of highly interactive interfaces. And my colleagues have given a lot of examples of how that is being analyzed and understood. But remember that what we're talking about here is a very broad spectrum of applications, and the ones that I have been talking about are the ones where you have, say, long-form analytical tasks. And so for these sorts of applications, yes, that one-third to three-second interval that Wayne mentioned is very important, but or maybe it was Ron, there's another dimension here that we've been starting to look at. It may be sort of cognitive rhythm or cognitive flow. You want to keep these people in this realm where perhaps they can make discoveries, they can have these aha moments, they can build their knowledge most efficiently. And so that's what I'm talking about, at least when I'm talking about interaction. The word has become overloaded in a way. It should be cognitive interaction or something else.
Okay, I'm really glad you said that, because I think that if we don't leave with somehow a sense of a unified view on an attack of what we're going to do, this has been another panel where we just discussed different ideas and left. What I would suggest is that you take one data set you can agree on and say, all right, let's attack that data set from different points of view. And now all of a sudden you're building something which pushes, put some comparative aspects on, somebody else can try the same data set on and on and on, and at least we're building seeds from those apples that might grow or something. But if you take diverse data sets and you show something and it's not repeatable and you can't compare it and we can't do anything, then you are growing science, I'll agree with that, but in a very, very local area. And I think we really have a responsibility right now to take a very broad view and start building things that everyone can use in certain situations. And VAST is an area that's generated data sets, and there are others being generated. Collaborate on the same data sets, see what happens. You're going to get some interesting results. Other people can compare it. And at the same time, you're going to help evolve the identification of what data sets are necessary so that we can push this even further. So I beseech you to try to coordinate on something that's more unified than you individually. Instead, I mean, don't go individually and pick five different data sets and do some great work, and then we're back to next year, the same place.
So what do you think, George? Do you think the VAST data sets might
I think it's a start. They're very, you know, I think there are a lot of problems in them, okay? But on the other hand, it's a start. They're not that difficult. You get some interaction, cognitive results on those things. You compare. You're going to get results. And then all of a sudden, there's five results and maybe more that you can start comparing and talking about. And you'll also be able to give us feedback on what's the problem with those data sets. So the whole this feedback loop now is starting to take a lot more power instead of just individually five groups going out or 150 groups as is currently happening. Everyone's going out doing different data sets. It's great value to see the horse. It's great value to see 3D stuff being put on a separate test. But if it ties back to some fundamental data set that somebody proposes and says, here's one, try something, then you've got something that other people can use. That was the beauty, by the way, of the UCI Irvine collection of data sets, in that everyone had a place to turn to take the breast cancer or smoking or something like that, try and compare, and it really helped get some understanding. Well, we've evolved from small data sets to reasonably larger problems, and we need to tackle those on those larger problems, not small ones.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting suggestion, and perhaps we should think even more and see if we can start with the vast data sets and what we would suggest that should be added to them, because we have this apparatus here. Maybe they could actually help us with that. Mm-hmm. But they are analytical data sets, and they are investigative data sets, so might be a good thing to look at.
And one thing I would say with that is, though, with the complicated analysis tests, you have the fact that inter-user variability is so high in people being able to perform the task that you really need a collection of equivalent difficulty for the problems, so that having different people do different tasks with different tools, you can compare. Because otherwise, or have the same person do five tasks that are of the same analysis difficulty, and getting a good measure to determine that. I mean, we've done things in simple diagnosis of maintenance problems, and some students all in the same class took 20 minutes to find out why the window heater didn't go on in the eyelash window of the cockpit. Other students took an hour and a half. And so if you're saying you're creating a computer interface to speed this up and you want to measure did it have any difference in performance, it's hard to show that 5 seconds makes a difference in that variability. And with these more complicated analysis tests that people might spend hours to multiple hours actually looking at, it'd be nice if we had a way to measure the cognitive load of the data set so we could say this is a set that is equivalent, and we could have the same person try 5 different interfaces on 5 equivalent data sets. So that's just another aspect of sort of maybe the next generation of vast data sets would be interesting.
But, you know, we're starting to make some headway, and I think some other people are too, and this is why you should try to do these analyses and set them up, because you can imagine that there will be, in the future, tests you can give these different individuals to categorize them cognitively. There probably are in cognitive science already.
Yeah, I mean, these are excellent ideas, and I have to tell you that one of the frustrations trying to work with other people's simulations are the fact that other people program them and not my group. And the reason this is a problem is not that they're actually done much better than my group could program, because we're not primarily programmers, but the problem is the right hooks are not built in for collecting the data that we really need to have. And they're so easy to build in when you're programming the system from scratch, and they're so hard to add elsewhere. I could tell you, and I think Lucy could verify, some of these horror stories that we both have seen from very different perspectives in the past, where we've actually worked with a group of programmers who are supposed to be building a system that our models are supposed to be using to interact with, or that our subjects were going to use to interact with, and they just couldn't get it straight what we wanted to collect and what we wanted to see. I mean, some of the stuff was just plain silly. So, for example, the model could see things on the screen which people couldn't see, and it couldn't see things on the screen which people could see. Those of you who program interfaces know that that's really easy to do if you throw the wrong switch. But if you're collecting human data using such a system, or if you're having a model which is going to act like a human using that system, then you got to get those things straight, else your data collection is really worthless.
I'm just for fun, I'm going to argue a completely different approach. And it's one I've been trying this last little while, and I don't know if it's going to work yet. And that is to go the complete opposite way, still keep your spirit of testing people on data sets and different ways of representing things, but to go with simple tasks, the idea to sort of reduce some of the complexity and variability because there's so many pieces. And so I've kind of, you know, taken a leaf from Rod Brooks and kind of just said, okay, let's just for simple things, you know, like looking for correlation, looking for simple patterns, what are good and what are bad, can we sort of work that out? And I don't know yet how it'll work. Stay tuned next year, I guess. You'll either see it'll work or it won't.
You can tell Ron and I are empiricists. When you start talking about running these complex experiments, we hide under the table.
But yet these tasks are relevant, like I say, perceiving correlation, all that. So there's still a certain degree of validity. It's just less, fewer degrees of freedom, as it were.
I just want to add, I'm not saying the opposite.
It keeps the spirit of testing.
Pick the same data set.
Yeah. No, actually, well, that's it. The data sets are common, so that part is
right.
Yeah.
You know, again,
you just got off onto
In medicine, they all use the same reagents. They all use the same cell lines. What you have to reconcile yourself with is you're in it for a slog. You're going to get some results, and you should always work for the results. You should be conscious that you're working for CF. You know, and you know this is a life-threatening disease, but you know, you really, you know, if you see this at Cogsci, they've been working on SOR and ACTR for, you know, many years, and progress is very incremental. But you know, there sometimes the slog is the only way to get where you want, and you just have to reconcile yourself to doing the hard work. And not every paper is going to be a gee whiz. You know, I've solved. You know, how long have we tried to cure cancer? Should we stop because we haven't succeeded? Nobody asks those questions in medicine. Sorry.
Okay. Don Jones from Booz Allen Hamilton, here for Defense Intelligence Agency. I'm starting to, I've been in this field for quite a few years, I've been playing around with it. One of the things that, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this without offending, I'll just do it anyway. You know, there's always two. I'm starting to formulate this opinion. There's this phrase that we always say that we need to run from. One is that I'm from the government and I'm here to help. And the second one that I think I just formulated is I'm a visual analytics professional and I'm here to make your job easier. And so I'm trying to figure out how to do that. And I'm in the trenches now. I'm doing things, designing and providing tools, providing to real analysts who are doing real work or putting their life and their colleagues' lives at risk daily. And so to me, it's a very personal thing. And so I'm trying to figure out what can I do to help them with their job. So I've kind of have this poll every time I go and talk to them and analysts and say, what is it that you need that to make your job or to make you understand the tool that would be help you the most? I've come down to four things, okay? Two of these I think cognitive science need to help with, okay? One is I need it to be intuitive. Two, I need it to be engaging. That's the first two. That's for the cognitive scientist. Three, I need it to be accurate. And four, I need it to be fast. And those are the elements of what they're looking for. And so I've had this. This is my study of about 10 people. And I continue to ask this, and I still get these same answers specifically. Would you like to care to answer that or respond? To anybody, it doesn't matter.
Let me take a maybe orthogonal whack at that. And you can come back because I suspect you won't be entirely happy with the answer. It's sort of interesting because I've worked in the human sciences all my career, and this we get pressures put upon us that I think my friends in physics and chemistry don't get put on them. Partly because if you're splitting atoms for a living and looking for subatomic particles, you know, nobody really wants the answer right away. You know, most people could care less. But the closer you get to the human side of things, so if you're a medical researcher studying cancer, well, there's people dying of cancer. And the society wants answers right now, right? If one of us had cancer, we want to know right now, what can you do for me, guy? We don't want somebody saying, well,
give me 100,000 hours a year in 10 years and I'll make a stab at it, you know. and point of fact, that's sort of, we need to do both things. So we need to be able to address practical problems right away, but we also sort of need long-term funding. We need these data sets which people have talked about, and they need to be collected so that they have the eye data, maybe the EEG data as well for lots of people, lots of variations. And it's very hard to sell funding agencies on that sort of funding. For example, we all know examples where communities have very short-term needs, and they start out with high aspirations. Well, we'll fund long-term research to develop the science base here. And after about, 6 to 7 months, the agency's priority changes, and they realize, well, they really have to solve these problems yesterday, so they're not going to support the basic research part of it anymore. They're going to support just the people who can say they can do it tomorrow, even though those people usually can't. So that's, there are other answers as well, but that's one answer.
NSF does have funding for research collection development for test collections, both in the computer and information science and engineering programs and in the Office of Cyber Infrastructure. Let's talk. I would argue that one of the things that could distinguish the VAST conference from all the others I know about is refusing to accept any paper about a system design that doesn't have some kind of empirical evaluation study with it. No more show and tell because it's pretty and it looks cool and we like it, but talk about effectiveness for an analytic task, and refuse to accept any paper, unless it's a theory paper, that doesn't have some kind of analytical component in proof of effectiveness.
We're going to get a lot more theory papers next year. No, I think you do actually see a lot of the papers that were submitted this year where people are doing some sort of evaluation, whether it's qualitative to quantitative to, simplified toy world problems. But it is good that the community sees that, and I don't know if it's a natural evolution of the field, that it's like first you could do something no one else could do, and now you've got to show that it's worth doing.
Yeah. No, I think it actually is part of the evolution of the field. I mean, if you take a look at other sciences, look at psychology, 100 years ago, a bit more, we've got an effect, let's show three friends and we write it up. Right, and now here we have develop the system. Let's show three friends. They like it. We'll go. Right, and in the century since, psychology's learned a lot about testing methodology. In tandem with development statistics, a lot of this was developed sort of jointly, and so that's really given it a lot of its power. And I think this is the way that this field will go too. There'll be more attention. If anything, there's a take home. I would say there's two messages. One is to consider seriously the development of more standardized evaluation techniques, and this whole issue, I think, is critical to advancement as a science. And the second is just talk, you don't have to study much cognitive science, don't study any, just buy your local cognitive person a beer. And occasionally, if you're going to talk to three of your friends, have them be one of the three friends. And so then you get at least the constraints from that point of view for pretty low cost and actually some fun. So, yeah.
Cognitive scientists like to drink beer, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
There we go. We're set.
So one question I'm just curious, with this discussion brought up to me, and I was curious to get the panelists' answers from, and that's when we were doing something, we wrote it up as cognitive task analysis. Some people we worked with said, oh, that's a bad word. Now it's knowledge discovery. And so it's like, I guess when you start working with people in a new field, you need to know which words to avoid and which ones were considered bad.
That's why I invented it.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I'm hoping to create a meme here.
So is that, has CTA turned into knowledge discovery phases, or do you still use CTA?
CTA is okay.
It is okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Probably time to wrap up.
Yeah. Well, we're officially over time by a few minutes. Thank you, everyone, for coming and for the vigorous interaction. I'm glad that we we sort of booked a whole lot of time for interaction, and there's always this question of whether we're going to be sitting here for a half an hour staring at the wall. So thank you very much for for asking questions and discussing.